My name is Malavika Prasad. I'm the host of the Your Favorite Book podcast, which is all about answering that big question, what's your favorite book and why? I have no real credentials. I just really love books, and I love sitting down with writers and readers to talk about the books that have inspired them, awed them, made them think, and just make them want to keep reading. And this week, my guest is Mina Sechkin, author of the new novel, The Four Humors. And Mina and I talk about not only her book, but about The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, a book which, spoiler alert, might be my favorite this year and one of my favorites of all time. Let's jump right into this. So you've got a book coming out. I really enjoyed your book. It's this lovely, meandering, introspective novel, but I'm sure you'll do a better job of describing it than me. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and this book you've got coming out?
Yeah, of course. So it's easier to talk about the book, at least at first. my novel, The Four Humors, is about a girl who is Turkish American, and she goes back to Turkey where her family is from. And she's there to take care of her grandma, who has Parkinson's, to grieve her dad's death, and to study for the notoriously just challenging MCAT, or challenging to, you know, start studying for if you don't want to do it. And she finds she cannot do those things, not very well. And instead, she becomes obsessed with the four humors theory of ancient medicine. And she stumbles upon a family secret.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of encapsulating all of that. And the thing that sticks out to me is her struggle, your main character struggle to study for the MCAT. And I read that and I was like, oh my God, I've been there. So I talked about this on the show. I'm a genetic counselor, so I'm in the medical field. But once upon a time, I was a pre-med student studying for the MCAT, and it was in that process that I really started to realize I did not want to be a doctor, not just because of the test, but like it puts it all in focus for you and you realize like just because being a doctor sounds nice and it helps people, like that's not the be-all and end-all of that profession.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I almost feel I wouldn't call my novel autofiction, but of course there are a lot of elements from my life, and that is definitely one of them. Not for me. I was never roped into the whole medical world by my family, who are very, in general, math, science. You know, we were raised with a lot of extra math studying, but both my siblings, my sister is a doctor and my brother just started medical school, and I've heard a lot about the MCAT. Yeah.
You captured it pretty well. Just that inertia of like, oh gosh, I'm supposed to study for this and time ticking by, but that's an aside. But the thing that struck me about your book is your book, you know, it takes place in this summer essentially, but it's kind of a broader space of time in which your character, Sybelle, am I saying her name correctly?
Sybelle.
Sybelle. She's studying for, you know, the MCAT, she's taking care of her grandmother, but it's sort of this extended space of time. And so I wonder, you know, writing a space of time like that, you know, was the ending of this story something you knew right away, or with Slice of Life, did the ending just kind of, you had to write it and see where it went? I'm curious to know like how you find the ending of a story like this.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I knew what the ending would be as soon as I conceptualized the family secret, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That I don't know if I should say. but the moment I knew that it concerned Sybelle's grandmother, mm-hmm. and something she was carrying to that day, I knew that it had to end with the way it ended.
Right.
Yeah. And I wrote the ending in the very first draft, even before a lot of the middle part was finalized. Yeah.
Okay. So the ending came to you first. I write similarly. I feel like I don't know a story unless I know exactly where it's going to go. And I've talked to other writers who are like, I find it along the way. I'm like, how do you do that? Like, I have to know where it's going.
Totally. And I definitely, in terms of the time frame of the summer, I knew from the very beginning that this book was going to take place in the whole summer that she's in Turkey, and that the final scene would be that feeling of needing to leave soon, that the airplane is that day, you know?
Yeah. I think it's something a lot of us, you know, children of immigrants or part of the diaspora, we can relate to. It's, you know, that traveling home for a summer or a month or that extended period of time that a lot of us kids grew up with. And, you know, there's this very defined stretch of time where life is just not like how it usually is. And it's a different universe that you step into for a while and then step out of. And that felt very relatable, even though I'm not Turkish, that still felt something I could resonate with.
I love that. That means so much to me as, that last scene, those airport scenes. It really is when you are in the motherland of your parents as that kid of immigrants, you really do, like you're saying, enter this portal of a different world, but it is literally still your world. It is your extended family and your family who you both feel very connected to, but also have such a giant divide with, which like can really hurt. I really felt like in this book, I was really writing towards that hurt of feeling like the insider outsider in Turkey every year sort of thing. Yeah.
You know, along those lines, there was a particular line, and I was like struggling to find the exact line verbatim, but I remember it paraphrased. And it's when she's remembering, you know, how her, you know, grandparents came to America and how they came here. And there's a line where she thinks, you know, I think about that because I imagine that I can do anything. Really, I don't do anything, but I like to imagine I could. And that line, I was just like, you hit it absolutely there, because all of us, I feel like we grow up with this idea, like our grandparents struggled, our parents struggled, and then we're sitting here in almost this limbo of guilt or apathy, and we're struggling with our first world problems, quote unquote. And that line just encapsulated it so well. I just had to like compliment that line. It wasn't even a question. I just had to compliment it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I feel like that is definitely, it hits on so many things that especially our generation of kids of immigrants, I feel like, feel, which, you know, I guess it's sometimes considered derogatory to call us millennials, but it's this aspect of our parents, yeah, gave so much up for us to be raised with certain opportunities. But what if we don't want to do anything?
Right. It's a different kind of struggle. It's not the same conflicts that they had, but they feel lesser, you know, whether or not they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really wanted the novel as a whole to speak to that sentiment, especially in terms of going into the past and telling her grandmother and these other stories, where it's especially kind of abrasive, I feel like, that sentiment, which is so real when you see all the things, especially with respect to women, that they could not do then, and how their lives were so strained and not fully lived because of what they couldn't do. But Sibel in our generation can really do whatever she wants, but does not feel that way.
For sure. And another thing that struck me about this book, and this is, I guess, more of a question. So Sibel is sort of what starts her whole fascination with the four humors are these headaches that she's having. And I noticed that these days we're getting a lot of books that feature chronic illness quite prominently, you know, the diagnostic odyssey patients go through or the impact it can have on family. And so I'm wondering where you consider your book or where you consider the headaches to fall. Do you consider these a representation of chronic illness, more of an exploration of grief, some sort of space in between that?
Yeah, that's such an amazing question. I really considered the headaches as more of a psychosomatic symptom, which doesn't delegitimize them in any way. And that's how I wanted them to appear in the book. but I also wanted to leave room for the feeling that Cybele feels as well, where it could be something more serious. It could be a chronic illness that then has its entire own host of a world of like diagnoses, misdiagnoses, not being treated by medical professionals or friends or family as being legitimate. So I wanted it to really rest in that place, pre-diagnosis, pre-understanding what it could be, and like what you are feeling is that one symptom really, and you don't know what it is yet. Yeah.
I think you did a good job of that, because we are given this indication. She's not been given any kind of diagnosis. She doesn't consider herself chronically ill, but she's just trying to get to the root of what's causing this, and nothing seems to fit. And so she clings to this idea of ancient medicine, the four humors, and it comes up in and out of the book. And I think it really is a nice segue into all the other things she's experiencing. So I think it was well done. And then coming back to like a craft, I'm jumping all over the place with these questions, but coming back to a craft perspective. So you make what I would consider the controversial formatting choice to not have any quotation marks for your dialogue. And so normally I've spoken about this. I don't usually like this stylistic choice. I think a lot of people usually don't like it. I think in your book, it really, really works. And I think the reason for that is everything is being filtered through Cybele's perspective, including the dialogue, including what she's hearing. And we have to trust what we hear, knowing it's filtered through her lens and not just letting it stand on its own. And I think with that reading frame in mind, it really works. And so I guess I'm wondering, that was my thought process reading it. What was your thought process in doing away with the quotation marks?
Yeah, I love that. You nailed it, really. I feel as if so much about this book is about, she's not exactly an unreliable narrator, but she is so internal, she is a bit delusional to her outside world. And so if there were quotation marks, every single thing that other people said would be the only truth in the book, or only reliable truth in the book. And it would almost call more into question everything else Cybele was saying. So I couldn't have given the dialogue of other characters that much weight over her narration, I feel like.
That makes sense. The only truth that we're getting is what she considers to be true. And we have to read it with that framing in mind. Otherwise, there is this disjointed narrative there. And I think that makes a lot of sense and kind of gives me a little, you know, pat on the back as a reader. I'm like, I got something. And now I'm curious, you know, kind of a fun, fluffy question I ask a lot of writers, like, tell me about, do you have a writing process? Do you have, you know, when you show up at the page to put the words down, do you have a routine that you like? Do you have rituals? What's your writing process?
I have a very chaotic writing process, which I like is, so I always consider when I'm first attempting to write a scene, when I'm at the very beginning, I call it a spit up. And it's just an open document and I'm just spitting it all out. Like it's throw up. Right. And then that always is the kind of writing that really puts me into almost a state of possession. Like I feel possessed in those moments, like time slips, it's gone. Right. Then I get into, I guess, the more type A part of my brain where the editing begins, like even just the shaping that spit up begins. And then there's the final part, which is, you know, editing everything down to the very line level, which I really, really care about. I will like look at a sentence and read it out loud for hours. But the spit up is the most fun.
It really is. It's that like free writing, throw it on the wall, see what sticks. And that like the possession state, because sometimes it can be a struggle to get like three words down. And when that happens, I know I'm usually thinking too hard.
And then in terms of rituals, I feel like I can write anywhere and I often write a lot in bed, which I have recently, it stopped working for me and now I have a proper desk, which feels really good.
I can't write in bed. I don't know how you do. I fall asleep. Like I can't do anything.
No, it's been happening lately. Yeah.
But I love that, though. I love that you give space for a chaotic writing process, because you always hear about the writer that's like, I sit at 4 a.m. and I have my cup of coffee and my three biscuits. And I'm like, this is relatable for no one. Like,
no
say
way.
That you write randomly like everyone else. Like,
totally. And yeah, of course, three biscuits. Mine includes so many snacks, just so many.
What's your writing snack of choice?
Well, okay. I've been trying to not eat as much sour candy, which has been, you know, a deep, deep source of joy for my whole life. Now it's dates, which is just also full of sugar and delicious. Yeah, I love dates.
It's a little healthier.
Fruit. A little, yeah. But still, I have the sour candy too. This is just more aspirational, an aspirational answer.
I like that. I really do. And so everyone, you know, I really recommend you pick up this book. I also want to say the cover that I have for this book is absolutely beautiful. Like, this is a beautiful cover. This was a really great book for like I said, it's an introspective, almost slice of life read. It slowly unfolds in front of you. It's a slow burn of a book. I really recommend it if you're in the mood for something like this. And I really enjoyed reading it. It gave me a view into a place I didn't know. Although it's very funny because this is like the second episode in a row I've done that featured Konya in some way. The last book I reviewed for that I did for the show was Ela Shafak's, one of her books. Someone chose it for the show. And I'm like, oh, here's Konya again. Now I see another view of this, but more modern. So,
yeah.
But I really enjoyed reading this.
Thank you. I'm so glad. So glad.
And now I want to dive into the book you chose for this episode. And that is The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. And the book we're talking about today, and in my opinion, I think for a lot of people, it's more of a modern classic. It's one of the most famous Indian novels ever written, especially in the West. And it's a book that's been on my reading list for a long, long time. So something I have to disclose to everybody. I've talked about it before. We mentioned earlier, I'm not Turkish. My family's actually from Kerala. I've seen a lot of the places referenced in this book. I have a working grasp of Malayalam. I've been to the Cochin airport, and somehow I hadn't read this book. I actually have been to an Arundhati Roy book signing for her second novel, and I still hadn't read her first one. I was just like, oh, here she is at the Brooklyn Public Library. I need to go. And I went and saw her, but I need to thank you for pushing me to read, in my opinion, what might be one of the greatest books I've ever read. Like, this book was amazing, and I'm so glad I finally read it. And before we get into, you know, where you were when you first read it, I'm going to give everyone listening a very brief summary. So essentially, Rahel and Esther are twins growing up in Kerala. They live in a small village outside Kottayam, which is a region in Kerala. Their life changes nearly in an instant with the arrival of Sofimol, who is their Anglo-Indian cousin. And this sets into motion a series of events involving family, politics, caste, and expectations, leading them to lasting impact on both twins that will haunt them for the rest of their lives. That is a very brief, very poor summary of such a complex book, but that was what I spit out in a few minutes. And so I struggle even knowing where to start with this. So I'm going to start with you. When did you first read this book and what struck you about it?
Wow. I just want to say I'm so glad that this book came to you at the right time and that
it really did.
It. Yeah. It really is. Talk about possession. It really is the kind that, has a lot of that energy in it.
Yes.
Yeah. So I first read it, in high school. I read 100 Years of Solitude as recommended to me by my mom and sister, who read a lot. And I read that book. It's also one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And then I think I was probably, you know, on the internet looking at other books, and this was recommended to me, and I went and bought it. I feel like at the time in high school, it's definitely not a, you know, simple, easy book to read. And I know that a lot of things went over my head reading it, at the time, but I was absolutely captivated by the language. The language is magical. It creates so many, it's so alive, and writhing almost. And so I was first really captivated by that. Then I read it a second time a few years later, and that's when things I really understood the book more. Mm-hmm. And then I read it a final time in a class at my MFA program at Columbia about novel structure. Mm-hmm. And of course, this one's very interesting because it's going into the past constantly. The past and the present are interwoven. There is no, say, like, sometimes when you read a novel with multiple time periods, there's clearly one that is craft-wise and emotion-wise very superior and, like, mm-hmm. the prioritized one. And sometimes that's intentional. Sometimes I feel like it's not. But in this one, there's no, I feel like both time periods are given just as much weight, which I think is one really amazing thing about the book.
Yes, you're hitting on so many of the best things about it. The language of this book, you're right, it blew my mind. It flabbergasted me that this was her debut and that she hadn't really studied writing. She was an architecture student. There are some elements of autofiction here, but and she just took a few years and wrote this book, and I'm like, changed the literary world, in my opinion. This book was, on a prose level, like each line, you could pick one out and it's like a little poem in and of itself. I loved it. And then you are completely right about the disjointed timeline. So my jacket copy actually compares the work to Faulkner's work. And I think that's a really apt comparison. I am a weirdo that loves William Faulkner.
Me too.
I love his books. Prose-wise, this is much more accessible than I would say something like The Sound of the Fury or Absalom, Absalom. This is more mm-hmm. accessible than that, but it plays with time in similar ways. It plays on that idea, that quote that's attributed to Faulkner. It's like, the past isn't even past and it's still here. I'm paraphrasing it, but this book, you know, it really interweaves the past and the present, like you said, and one isn't given more weight than the other. The two are always influencing. They're always intermingling, and there's none of the clear division even. It's not like this chapter is the present, this chapter is the past, in a very clean way. It's all kind of brought in together, and it can be hard to follow at times. You know, it's a complex, difficult read, but I think it's very rewarding. Oh gosh. There's so much I loved about this. I think I also need to say, you know, this is a book that handles a lot of really difficult topics as well. So, you know, there's trauma is one of the guiding themes in this book, you know, the impact of trauma, where it comes from. In this book, it stems from violence, abuse, molestation, a lot of other sources, you know, ingrained sociopolitical dynamics. If you're someone who can read this kind of content and someone who appreciates a complex narrative, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
Yeah. You couldn't have said it any better. Yeah. And I haven't reread Faulkner in a while, but in high school I was a Faulkner freak. Like, I really, really was into these books. And I feel like, yeah, especially The Sound and the Fury. The Sound and the Fury was my favorite book for a very long time.
Me too. Period.
Yeah. Oh, it's again the language and the rules that are being broken, and not just in terms, and this is the same for God of Small Things, where it's that, yes, rules are being broken in the language, but also rules are being just like intensely broken in terms of like the traditional family structure and mm-hmm. when people err out of that traditional family structure with respect to one obvious element, but mm-hmm. also with respect to class, race. Yeah. So yeah. I feel like that is the thing about both that is really, really makes it really, really good. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it's all encapsulated in this phrase, the love laws, which basically, you know, Roy phrases it as who can be loved, how much, and how, essentially. And we see this in a variety of different ways, obviously in a central plot point, but also in smaller ways. You know, baby Kochima, for example, having this long love for an Irish priest, like mm-hmm. that's not okay. That's not allowed. And then even Chaco marrying a white English woman, and divorces, and all these different relationships that we see that are not expected, not traditional. And then of course, veering into some of the other relationships that they see. It's just, nothing is cut and dry. Nothing is clean. There's a lot of messiness here just in general. I also really liked how the book uses a lot of children sort of meandering thought patterns in the prose, so, you know, little songs, you know, sort of echolalic speech, you know, things coming up over and over again. It's children processing these incredibly difficult topics. And that's brought on the page in such a cool way. It did remind me of Faulkner when we get some of those Benji chapters. Obviously, Benji was not a child, but him processing what's around him in his limited perspective, it reminded me a lot of that.
Definitely. Yeah. And even, and I feel like that is one of the more heartbreaking tools that's used in this novel. Mm-hmm. It's just so heartbreaking to watch the child's perspective of this family start to, you see where the breaks are and you see them like witnessing where the breaks to this family will begin. And even in the name of the orange drink, yellow drink man.
Yeah.
Just devastating. I just got chills. Yeah.
Yeah. Every time that came up and just seeing those things just appear on and on again, or something as simple as, you know, there's a little scene where Rahel makes a joke or a comment to her mother and everyone stops. And then her mother says, you know, when you make a rude comment, that causes someone to love you a little less. And that broke my heart, because Rahel carries that forever. She compares herself to her brother, to Sophie Mole, who's, you know, white and favored and loved from the beginning and all of that. And you just see this constant comparison, and she's just a little child and doesn't have the language to express how that makes her feel. And it's just like just an innocuous statement like that, that wasn't meant probably the way Amu intended it. It was just, yeah, you just see this all through the lens of a child, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so heartbreaking. And, it's very interesting too, because I always think about in writing, I never want to, over explain something that is cultural that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
That is in Turkish culture, right?
Yeah.
I never want to over-explain that in prose, because then I would be catering to a gaze that is dominant, that doesn't know it. And by over-explaining it, I am further reinforcing that gaze, right?
Right.
And I feel like in God of Small Things, there, it doesn't exist. The gaze doesn't exist. There's no explanations. And I love that so much. It makes it feel so just like direct from the source. And like, if you have questions, look it up, you know?
Yes.
And I feel like the child's perspective also really helps with that, because like children sometimes explain things that they know when they're then like talking about it, but really it was just so immediate and raw, and everything, like the way the kids talk about Sophie Mole and like her mm-hmm. being different from them, her being white, like it's done so effectively. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm glad you pointed out that you liked that space where if you didn't know something, you didn't want it over explained to you, because that was the perspective I was looking for in talking to someone about this book. Because I'm a second generation kid, but like my family grew up in Kerala. I knew a lot of the terminology, the foods, you know, they reference wearing mundas a lot of time. And it's like, most people have never seen a munda before, but it's like, I knew a lot of this, and I vaguely could sketch out a lot of this. And I was wondering, you know, am I attached to this book because it's one of the first representations of a culture my family comes from on the page that I've read? Or is it because, you know, the book stands on its own? And I think it's a little bit of both. I think when you love a book, you can acknowledge that it hits something close to home for you. But you're exactly right that this doesn't pander to a Western gaze. And that's why I'm so surprised that this was so popular in the West too. You know, it won the Booker. In India, I know this book was controversial. It's very explicit with things like sexuality. I even asked my mom, who read this book, you know, closer to when it came out and lived there specifically in the area. And she loved it, but she told me, you know, it does cram in a lot of sociopolitical issues all into one book, and at times can feel a little heavy-handed, and you're kind of breezing past a lot of different things, like the communist movement in Kerala and casteism and things like that. And those sections can get a little heavy-handed, but I was like, I still love this book. I mean, it's hard for me to find fault with it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And especially what your mom said about putting it all in there. That is something that I know that if it was like the exact history I knew everything about, and then I was reading all of it in one book, like I would be more, something would be tuned a little differently in my reading. But yeah, that I feel like is when a book manages to be both universal while being very specific, I feel like that is one of the most incredible things.
It really is. It's no people read the same, no two people read the same book. And you're right, it's the universality and the specificity of it. And it's like, even if you don't know what Kapan Minkari or Mundas or any of that is, like you can still appreciate the world that she's creating. And you know, now we've got Google, we can look things up. I mean, this book came out in 1997 and it wasn't as easy to look things up, but now we can. And I mean, she does a good, like, even the Malayalam in this book is usually translated on the next line. Like, you're not left entirely in the dark. Although I will say, for people who kind of want to hear some of these words out loud, there's a really excellent audiobook that actually came across that I listened to while also reading this interspersed. And it was just nice to hear, and everything was pronounced quite well. And it was just done really well on audio as well. And so that's a great way. If you just want to know, you know, how this sounds or how these words come together, like that's a great way to experience a book as well.
That's cool. I should check it out.
Yeah, it's really great. It's free on YouTube, actually. I found it.
Oh, nice.
And so I want to transition this over to talking about other books that we'd recommend. And you actually brought up one of the ones I would have brought up as well, and that's 100 Years of Solitude, because, you know, that sweeping family saga, that complicated narrative, the taboo nature of a lot of what goes on in that book. And, you know, it's a whole culture that's not your own, I think, and the prose being so beautiful. I love that book too. I think that's a really excellent comparison, and it's one I've brought up before on the show. I think The Sound and the Fury, again, you know, that's a great read. My story of The Sound and the Fury, I took a whole summer when I was 13 and said, I'm going to read this. And how much I understood at 13, I have no idea. But on the internet back then, somebody had put together like a color-coded version so you could trace all the flashbacks to like where they were supposed to go. And that's how I read it when I was 13. And I probably still read it the same way, but it was enough for me to fall in love with the book, even though I probably understood nothing.
I love that. That's really incredible.
And so I'm curious, Mina, what books you would recommend for either someone new to The God of Small Things or just books you really love?
So again, 100 Years of Solitude, 100%. I feel like the two books are communicating with each other in kind of asserting that the personal is always political, especially when there's this trauma rooted with this country's history and the West kind of looming in the back. And yeah, I would 100% recommend that. I've read that book maybe 8 times. Yeah, it's definitely the book I've read. I was actually debating between this book and that book. But I love that. And then another favorite, in general, my favorite, I have two sort of subgenres that are my favorites. One is the intergenerational family saga, right? That these would both fall under. And the other is definitely, and I guess this speaks to my book a little more in some way, the kind of millennial alienated cerebral narrator. And I always was really frustrated that I didn't see many books that did both at the same time. And now there are a lot more, I feel like, millennial narrators who are people of color, who are kids of immigrants, who have multicultural backgrounds, and they're not just like pigeonholed into now you're going to read a cliched immigration story. Like, no, they are actually doing something else. Yeah, and those books I really love, and there I would really recommend books like Pizza Girl by Jean Kayan Frazier. And Sour Heart by Jenny Zhang. Just I love that book so much. It is so candid and like obscene about sex and young girls and what they do. I really, really love that book. And also my personal kind of like foundational text in this regard, in terms of my own identity as a Turkish American person, definitely The Idiot by Edith Bachman. And I was debating that book too for today. yeah.
You were speaking my language with these books. I was like, yes, I love Pizza Girl. Yes, I love Sour Heart. Like, I need to read The Idiot. That would be the only one I haven't. But you are totally right. These books speak to this alienated, you know, immigrant millennial perspective. And it's not just the good immigrant, you know, we're living up to all our parents' expectations and being this model person. And I talked about this with a previous guest, Sanjana Sethian, who wrote Gold Diggers, and talking about, you know, unpacking that model minority that a lot of us deal with, or just this idea that we are living up to expectations. Sometimes we don't, and sometimes we fail, and we falter, and we are in a malaise, or in the case of Pizza Girl, a lot of drinking while pregnant, which as a genetic counselor, I was like, no, no, no. But
yeah, right.
It was like a lot, but these are great recommendations, and I definitely need to pick up The Idiot. I've seen that on a lot of lists. Another book I'd probably recommend to you, if you like sort of the, and this book reminded me, it's another previous podcast guest, but when I was reading your book, one of my guests, her name is Nicola DiRobertis Thai, wrote a book called The Vietri Project, which is very much a millennial coming, not a coming of age, but an alienated millennial journey perspective, uncovering a family secret kind of thing. And it's that same kind of narrator who is, everything is filtered through her view. There's this self-absorption here, not really aware of the other world around her. And I loved both of your books. So Nicola, if you're listening to this, shout out, you wrote a great book. But it's definitely a style I love too. And I'm glad more and more people are writing it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm definitely going to get that book. That sounds incredible.
It also has a beautiful cover. I mean, shout out to these cover designers. They're doing a great job.
They really are. Yeah, I love it.
All right. Mina, thank you so much for everything you've brought in. You know, if we're looking to find you and your book, where can we find you?
You can find me. My Instagram handle is Little Butta, B-U-T-T-A. Yes.
You didn't go for the like at Mina's Mina author.
No,
like.
I did not. Yeah, this was a nickname that was given to me in college because I really enjoy food, and apparently I would always make really good food, but I cheated because I used a lot of butter. So,
I love it.
But my Twitter handle is my first name, last name, Mina Sethian. Yeah.
Got it. So you went more professional for the Twitter.
Yeah.
But definitely, yep, check out Mina's book. You know, I'll have links to buy it in the show notes. Definitely keep an eye out for The Four Humors, and definitely read The God of Small Things if you haven't. I hope you're not like me and actually read this book a while ago instead of sleeping on it for so long. But if you haven't, you know, if you're in the mood to have your heart broken, pick it up. Because like, I knew what was coming at the end because of the disjointed timeline, and I still cried at the end. So that's talent right there. And so, Mina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation.
And thank you for listening to this week's episode of Your Favorite Book. If you like us, keep an eye out for episodes every other Thursday. And if you like the show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at YFBpodcast. And if you're so inclined, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting platform. The reviews really do help, and it helps the whole visibility algorithm and whatever else is involved. So yes, thank you for listening, and happy reading.